Hi, I'm Deke Antrim, and this is my podcast, Sidetracked. I've been a longtime admirer of director John Carpenter and his ability to perform movie magic with little to no money. Carpenter has always worked outside the Hollywood mainstream and instead opted for more creative control over his art, a gamble in which the winnings are on full display in his extraordinary filmography. As always, we speak our minds here on Sidetracked, and there are major spoilers ahead. You have been warned.
You know, one thing they taught me in film school was no matter what, if you're a gun for hire or you write the screenplay yourself, no matter what, make it your own film. Make it personal. Bring something to it. One of my teachers at film school was Orson Welles, and he said, look, sometimes I do scripts because there's a great chase in the third, in the tenth reel, and I can do something with that chase. He said, I just don't do it for necessarily the whole movie, but when I do it, it's all mine. So I have the same philosophy.
This episode begins our six-part retrospective of one of the most influential directors of all time, Mr. John Carpenter. For such an expansive career deep dive, I needed an expert. And there's only one person I can think of for the job, which is why I brought in Mark. It's All in the Reflexes Tally. Mark, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Checks in the mail.
Yeah. Like the wind. All right, so Mark, I always try to do podcasts with friends that I love talking to, but I usually give them the carte blanche as far as like what you want to talk about. And I gave you a couple of different choices. And why did you end up deciding on the John Carpenter career?
Well, first of all, thank you for the intro. Hopefully my reflexes won't fail me tonight. Carpenter, he's one of my favorite filmmakers. Halloween's my favorite horror movie of all time. We've talked about this at length. Strap in. Strap on? I'm just kidding. Sorry. I love his movies. His whole work throughout the years of his career have, by and large, good, great, wonderful stuff. Now, later on in his career, we'll get there. And some of those I haven't seen, which is good. I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I'm actually, you know, as we go along in this retrospective career path that is John Carpenter, I'm interested to see like when we do the deep dives, which ones it was the first time for. I'm interested to see because you always kind of surprise me sometimes. You and I talk at length a lot about movies, and I'm always kind of surprised because you have so many movies that you would have seen that no one else that I know would have seen, and then some of like straight up what I would think classics or something that you, of course, you've seen a million times. You've really kind of surprised me with some of your first timer
or
movies.
that I've never seen.
And that always kind of surprises
me. Honestly, but the three we're going to talk about tonight, Halloween, of course, countless times, Assault on Precinct 13, this tonight was just my third time seeing it ever. And then The Fog, I've seen a handful of times. I don't know it like the back of my hand, like Halloween, but I still have seen it a bunch of times. So right away, Assault. I'm kind of brand new to it.
I really think John Carpenter is the Johnny Cash of movies.
You see that?
Whether you love him or hate him, you know it's a John Carpenter movie. Besides the fact, name's over the title of every movie, but very specific tone and feel and rhythm and dialogue for a lot of his movies. And it's something that once you've kind of gotten used to the branding of John Carpenter, just fall in love with him. And so besides influencing other directors, which we'll talk about also, for me, the big thing is he was just the director who he had almost zero budget, but he didn't let the budget ever interfere with what his vision needed to be. He had huge ideas with low budgets. And I think that's ultimately some of the people that you and I talk about, you know, kind of religiously, like Romero and now Carpenter and some other people I'm sure we'll talk about later on in other podcasts. But he just was able to stretch a dollar. And that's what I fucking love about him. That's the most admirable aspect of him as a director. So
And his look too, just the, I don't want to say slick, because I don't know if his movies come off as slick, but he's got that Panavision lens, that super widescreen, always with that.
He definitely is a director who has an arc to his career, and we have to address that as it is. I'm looking forward to going over it, the ups and downs, but ultimately iconic career that is John Carpenter. For this retrospective, I already told you this, but we are going to be skipping Dark Star. Is there anything, 30-second little blip you wanted to mention about it?
Here's one of those moments.
Okay.
I have not seen Dark Star. This is one of those moments. Now, awesome. I told you earlier, but when we were talking about this, that I would try to work it in because I do own it on Blu-ray. It's so funny. Even though I've never seen it. So, I just haven't put it in, but I wanted to put it in. almost did today, and there's no way. I mean, I was already a little bit late getting here, so I was like, if I had watched that, it would be a disaster. But anyway.
Also, for the record, and I'd like to keep a tally of this, no pun intended, but that is blind buy count number one on the podcast.
Yes, there we go. There we go. You know what? How about let's put a pin in it, and if I watch it in the meantime, when we get back for the next three, we can maybe discuss it a little bit.
All right, sounds good. All right, so possible 30-second review of Dark Star coming down the road, possible. All right, so let's jump into Assault on Precinct 13, 1976.
Precinct 13, cut off, isolated in the middle of a city, as a human wave of street killers turns the night into a nightmare.
We got a war going on down here. We can't find the damn thing.
A white-hot night of hate. Assault on Precinct 13.
Carpenter, he's still alive. You know what? R.I.P. Carpenter. No.
Where's my 40? No.
Oh, we're going to feel shitty when.
Yeah, I know. I know. I know. Yeah, I know.
Because my boy's looking like Lopan about now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
No, he is a big fan of Howard Hawks, mm-hmm. old movies. He said this countless interviews, mm-hmm. even when in Halloween, when he snippets of The Thing from Another World.
Right.
This movie feels like total Western.
Oh, yeah.
Like, set up everything. It's like an urban Western. It's great.
It felt like a frontiersman protecting, you know, maybe from a raid of some kind or something like
it's
that.
It's like a classic Western setup. You got these heroes, they're holed up, they're surrounded. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the big thing. It's a shootout. Yeah. It's awesome.
Right off the bat, I want to talk about the score.
It's the first thing I have, kick-ass Carpenter score.
I mean, you can't beat that score, but it was kind of loosely based on the Immigrant Song by Led Zeppelin.
Okay, that's
cool. And once you know that fact and you listen to dun-da-da-da-na versus dun-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you're like, oh shit, that is Immigrant Song.
All of a sudden, Napoleon Wilson's like,
exactly. Yeah. Quick question, have you seen the movie Love by Gaspar Noé?
No. Not to be repeating you, but no.
It's his parents' fault for not having the last name of Yes.
No, I've heard about it. I've heard about his works too. I've heard it's nothing but like crazy stuff.
Yeah, I do recommend the movie highly. I recommend all his movies highly to you. Yeah. It is a straight up porno.
Literally,
he shot it in 3D, so he wanted to be the first person to shoot a pornographic movie like in 3D, and the posters were like super not safe for work and blah blah blah. Anyways,
Into the Void.
Exactly. It was Enter Everything, but the dragon, it was everything. But they used the score from Assault from Precinct 13. Of course, it's during I'm not saying, oh, this is a pretty raunchy movie. Like, it's a porno with a plot, but it's a porno. So I'm going to be very clear about it before anyone takes my advice and then doesn't realize I'm not joking at all. It is a brilliant use of the song. And now, because of that movie and being a fan of his music, I love this score.
He uses the score for Assault on Precinct 13.
Yes.
Wow.
During porno scene. And I got to tell you, it is art.
You know what?
It's art.
It kind of sounds.
No, it's great.
I can hear it as a porn.
It's great.
Porn soundtrack.
It's absolutely fantastic. It's absolutely great. I love
That's
it.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, now I want to. I might watch that before Dark Star.
I was going to make a terrible joke, but I will leave that one off the table. So yeah, he wrote in 3 days, which I thought was really cool.
That's crazy. Yeah. That's what I love about hearing how short mm-hmm. his work is to come up with iconic sounds.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is insane to me.
Yeah.
And I know his dad was a music teacher, so some of it rubbed off on him, and maybe he was made to take piano.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
But I love like the simplicity of his scores. Mm-hmm. I love it.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't want to say there's no depth to them because clearly, you know, there are themes, but that's the thing I want to strike on. He really just has themes.
Yeah.
Across the board themes. There's really no background music. Maybe tonally there is. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of moments in this movie where it's just, you know, just to emphasize the suspense.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love his themes. So I've got like 10 of his scores on vinyl.
Yeah. Just a quick little side story. You're the one who got me into vinyl and I'm like huge into it now. I got to be very careful about what I spend my money on sometimes. And you just kept like showing me this stuff. I will fully admit that I was getting just fucking jealous every single time. You're like, look at this score. And it's a, you know, like limited edition colors and all this stuff. And I was like, man, I really want to get into this, you know? And so I think I asked for kind of just a cheapo record player. And ever since, I've been in love, and I love it.
It's easy to fall into.
Oh, yeah.
Like, my wife hates it. But
that's funny.
But, you know, we've come to an understanding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No,
yeah.
I really, it's easy to fall into, but it's easy to get into also.
Yeah, it's
like,
great.
You can really just like hit the ground running.
Oh, man, I come home from work and I pop on like a great soundtrack, like to Big Trouble or, you know, or whatever, or, you know, like When You Came Over Tonight, you know, playing. He's got the new anthology vinyl that came out, and it's just got remastered of all his biggest hits. It's awesome.
Yeah, I walked down, I was like, I hear the fog.
Yeah, it's great. I love listening to vinyl. But yeah, great score. It was great to see Tony Burton from Rocky.
Yeah, that's what I was doing some IMDb when I was first watching it, like for the notes.
And The Shining.
And I was like, oh man, Apollo's trainer. Yeah, like, this is great.
Yeah, it's awesome. And I thought he was great in it, man.
He's
the fact
pretty
that
good.
He was like shooting blanks the entire time was, that was a great comic relief.
Yeah, it's a good moment too. Because you don't really know. And I guess that Carpenter did a pretty genius thing where you never see anybody fall out there.
Right, right.
You do see them run by, though. I think there's a couple of shots where even in the firefight, you see those guys running by.
Right.
And none of them are falling down, but you don't think of it.
Yeah. You and I just did a pretty awesome screening of Assault. This movie very much closely resembles Night of the Living Dead to me.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the things that was notorious for Night of the Living Dead was to have an African-American lead. And now, especially for how old that movie is, I mean, that's almost never heard of back then.
What was it, 69, right?
Yeah,
68, 69?
Like yeah.
Something like that.
And people weren't doing that stuff. Yeah. And
it was envelope pushing, for sure.
For sure. And now you're seeing it, and I felt like this movie was a lot like Night of the Living Dead. And once again, you have another African-American lead actor. Interesting that there wasn't a lot of people doing that back then. It's something that Carpenter has done often in his career where he puts a black male lead, which that may not always sell as popular back then when he was coming up. And then the fact that you have, like, you know, pretty much like sworn enemies coming together, almost like a Hateful Eight situation, having to team up because there's an even bigger evil outside, you know.
That's kind of cool. One could argue another Western theme there.
Did you ever get around to watching the remake again recently?
Again, I wanted to, but I did not. I have seen it, though.
Okay,
I saw it's just cardinal sin. I saw it before the original.
Right,
and I normally go, okay, I'm waiting on the remake. Mm-hmm. I'm going to watch the original first and try to make a study out of it, you know. But I think it was on HBO one night years ago, and I was like, hey, whatever, I'll watch this.
I did recently watch it.
Not that this matters, the Hill of Beans at all, but I think I might watch the remake.
Well, soon. Okay, fuck it. We'll just do it right now. It's got some pretty interesting things in there, man. So if you haven't seen it, let's do like a little recap of it maybe later on down the line. But I will say I didn't hate it. And as far as Carpenter remakes go, possibly maybe one of the top three. I mean, it's not bad. It's a little goofy fun, and it's very violent. There's some stuff going on right in the first 15 where you're like, oh, shit, this is...
There's Adriana from Sopranos.
And Leguizamo was killer in it.
That's like, right. Is he one of the Cholos? Or is he...
No, he's some sort of... Like,
was that bad of me?
Yeah, no. He did this whole thing about how racially forward Carpenter was.
I promise you, that's not my normal knee jerk.
He's just one of the prison inmates.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I gotcha.
Yeah, yeah. And he's great in the role.
Do they do potatoes?
No. And let's talk about that now, because that's on my list. I'll be honest with you, it's like right around.
It's such an
whatever,
odd,
like,
not to jump the gun.
I think it goes like Ice Cream Girl, potatoes, like literally in my list, and we will come back to that.
It's such a weird. It's a weird moment, but it's great though. I think it's funny. I love it.
1 day, 2 day, 3 day, 4, 5 day, 6 day, 7 day, more, 8 day, 9 day, 10 by 11, kiss my ass and go to heaven. Why, oh, you spelled you.
I told you I'd lose. God damn it, we're going to do it again.
Hey, there wasn't time.
And it is better than a coin toss, I guess, but God, it's so weird.
I was kind of hoping that, maybe I was reading too much into it, but it looked like they were really punching each other's fists pretty hard on this screening we just did. And I don't know
and
if I had noticed
going
that
the
before.
Alternate, like,
like
he's a quick training Apollo.
Yeah, and I could almost see, like, in prison, like, there would be who gives in first as far as punching each other's knuckles as hard as you
like
possibly can.
Like, that's how they decide
time.
A lot of stuff.
So I'm trying to give it a little, I'm trying to give it a little bit more credit than possibly it is, because it
does
come off a little.
You're playing potatoes.
Yeah, I know. I'm like speed bagging my mic over here. Shame on me. What the fuck? But
well, it's just so weird because he's like, well, what are we don't got a coin. He's like, potatoes. The way he says it too.
And the movie's so serious up into like this almost musical interlude of them punching each other.
And
it was
did
weird.
You notice it holds on there for a little bit, but then it cuts to this really nice dolly shot of Lee. Right, just watching them going like, what?
Yeah, yeah.
The whole time they're doing their count. I found it really funny. I noticed the shot more this time.
Yeah, it's a bit of a goofy scene, but yeah, anyways.
And then he's like, damn it, I lose. Let's do it again. Whatever. Yeah, exactly. God, it's hilarious.
Hey, before we talk about Ice Cream Girl, the character Black Warlord, did you happen to see what patch was on his beret?
I saw it. Was there an eagle on it? I
thought it's an innocent looking girl on roller skates. Oh, it is the most odd fucking thing for this demented, you know, gang leader who just is hell-bent on killing everybody and his whole gang.
Maybe that was the
last victim's hatch or
something? Yeah, maybe. Oh, or God. Maybe the crest I noticed or the patch I noticed was on the problematically titled Oriental Warlords.
Oh, God, like, I didn't see that.
Dude, no. It was White Warlord, Black Warlord, Chicano Warlord, and Oriental Warlord.
Oh, wow, that's crazy.
And then there was like goons or something like that, or chief down the line.
Oh, God.
That's crazy.
If you get the chance next time, it's a girl on roller skates and she looks very cute. And I'm like, why is that hat is an odd choice? That's a flex of a wardrobe choice right there, I thought.
Division 13.
Oh,
Precinct 9, whatever they say. Yes. We talked about that during the movie.
This actually isn't Precinct 13. This is District 13,
Precinct 9. Yeah. And then the building itself actually says District 14.
Right, that's right.
I really like how Carpenter sets the stage for his movies musically, like almost across the board.
Yeah.
There's always an extended credit sequence with his score or Morricone's score on the thing. Yeah. There's like a really long drawn out thing where you hear those tones, you know, after the
Miss credits like that, you know. Yeah. I we don't get that anymore,
honestly. It's like an overture in a way, like speaking of the Ten Commandments in 4K, the movies, you know, they don't have that anymore. Mm-hmm. It's they don't have programs anymore, all this stuff. Oh yeah. Well,
yeah.
Tarantino's throwback. Yeah. But dude, I started thinking in these credits when I was sitting down before tonight, I was like, Carpenter always does that in Halloween.
Yeah.
There's a whole extended thing with the theme just with on credits. Escape from New York, similar thing.
I think that kind of calls back to what I was talking about earlier about his branding. You always know in the first 30 seconds, even if it's in pitch black, you know it's a Carpenter movie. He has a feel and a tone before he's even brought the lights up. And I love that. The most controversial scene in the movie is the ice cream girl. So yeah, the girl, there's a 9-year-old, 10-year-old girl.
She was like the Disney staple at the time for the live action.
Witch Mountain movies.
Okay. Yeah.
Gotcha.
She even gets the and credit.
It's a pretty gruesome scene, obviously. I would definitely say I've seen about 90% of Carpenter's movies. I think I've seen 90% of them, possibly, in the entire movie category of John Carpenter. I don't think there's been anything that violent. Do you think?
And I not against a younger person like that.
Well, like a child, a female, innocent child holding an ice cream cone. You know,
there's nothing.
It doesn't get any more sweet and innocent. I mean, it's like literally putting a Hallmark card at the end of the target range.
A vanilla ice cream cone. I mean, that's just like.
Not that I'm saying it's her fault, but had she not been so hell bent on getting that vanilla twist, would she still be alive?
Maybe. Or should the ice cream man had given her the right damn flavor?
Let's put it back on the older guy.
Or should her dad have not drug her out? Because he used her as a bargaining chip to get her nanny, I guess it was, to come and live with them.
True. Well, beyond that, he's handing her pocket change in a heavy intersection. There's like a cross section of roads there. And he's like, go ahead and blah, blah, blah. The gun scope camera, you know, scans over multiple other people and they don't shoot. So you're thinking, well, this movie's not going to really pull the trigger. And then you're thinking, there's no fucking way they'll shoot the little girl. No, they do. That
spray is like insane.
So we're talking the most violent thing that Carpenter does in his entire career is in the first half hour of his first movie. That's pretty crazy.
It's nuts.
Man.
It's nuts. And if you think about how goreless Halloween is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, true.
Maybe it was.
And if you think about him reacting as a master of horror, which we both do, that's a big thing to talk about in the first half hour of his film career.
Well, I know in interviews, I've seen him many, many times say he regrets that.
Yeah.
Like he regrets doing it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just overall. And honestly, I'm going to say, I'll just say it. I'm glad he did it because
me too.
It is crazy. It is bonkers level nuts. Like her, and going back to what I was saying, like even leading up to her death, she is just like chipper, like sitting in the car, going over lines with her dad.
Yeah.
Hilarious because when you rewatch it, you know what's coming. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh my God.
Oh, yeah.
She is laying it on thick. I wanted a vanilla twist. Mm-hmm. Boom.
Yeah. I mean, you got to think about it. To get butts in the seats, basically like grindhouse films, you had to have a hook. And if you had friends coming up to you and say, hey, man, I just saw this crazy ass movie. And at the beginning of the fucking movie, they shoot this 9-year-old girl. You're never going to believe.
Yeah. No way.
Shoot this 9-year-old girl. You got to see this movie.
Yeah, they're remembering it wrong or something. And then you get them in there to go, oh my God.
Yeah.
For sure. And you talked about grindhouse level filmmaking. Mm-hmm. This is like the slickest grindhouse movie mm-hmm. that's ever been made. It mm-hmm. really does have that grindhouse feel. And I love it.
Yeah.
And I love even the way he puts the supers at the bottom, like he superimposes the time.
The time.
You know something's he's going good at that to happen.
The wrist bracelet for Snake. And he's good at like keeping the pressure constantly on you. His score does that a lot. But he also does like visual cues like that. I think he does that in The Fog too, where he lets you know like at what point in night you're getting into and stuff like that. And Halloween has dates too, right?
It has dates. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It doesn't have the time. Like that's what I love about this movie is that the time keeps coming up. Mm-hmm. So you know, you're like, okay, well, we're headed towards something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even if you don't like, especially if you don't know what it's about, but even if you have heard an inkling of what it, that it's about a siege, it's a goddamn siege.
Yeah,
not to quote the hero, but you feel something just coming down the road and you're like, oh,
yeah,
it's great.
Yeah. So the MPAA, said they were going to give it a rated X for that scene.
Really?
Carpenter cut that scene out just for the print that he sent to the MPAA and they approved it.
God.
And then on the theatrical cut prints, he was put out, he put the girl, and because it was such a low budget, no one was really kind of paying attention, he never got busted for it. So I thought that was awesome.
That is amazing. And again,
leads back to why I think he's the Johnny Cash of fucking filmmaking because he is a rebel. He's a straight up rebel. That's why I have a lot of admiration for him.
But there's an element to his structure when he puts a movie together. Mm-hmm. Maybe, I don't know if it's the script phase. I mean, that's why his name's above everything. Although I don't remember if it's
this
above.
Is this, not,
yeah, that's what I was thinking.
The first one. Yeah.
And then from then on, that's all it is. Yeah. Even his Masters of Horror, I think, have his name above, I think.
Interesting.
We'll get there. When Bishop first gets to the precinct and, you know, you get that cool organ, right? Mm-hmm. Great stuff. He's looking around and Carpenter, and I love how Carpenter does this. And he does it in Halloween, at least toward the end of the movie. I'm sorry, the very end of the movie. But he's looking around the precinct and you see every shot that he's going to show you throughout the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a sense of geography about the place. You see the parking lot across the street. Mm-hmm. You see the road leading up.
Interesting.
You see the side of the thing. And he takes a few beats to let the hero look around.
Mm-hmm.
And he shows all this to you, like, here's where it's going to play out.
That's interesting.
And it's like another way for you to go, oh, what's about to happen?
He does that in the beginning of Prince of Darkness, too. He gives you a real good layout of the campus and the church and where everyone's at. So
that's
interesting that you brought that up.
It's like he's using the cops training almost.
Mm-hmm.
He's like surveying the scene. He's looking at exits and stuff. But at the same time, for us, he's showing us the stage where it's all going to play out. And I just love that about Carpenter. Mm-hmm. And with Halloween, all of the shots of like the Wallace house, the Doyle house, the Myers house.
True.
You know what I mean?
And it's usually the girls walking around kind of giving you the viewer, the lay of the land.
Or the staircase that Laurie falls down.
True.
Or the place where she has to bust the window. Yeah, like you're seeing all of these just setups.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Good. So it's not a complete like, where the hell did that come from later on?
Yeah.
It's good.
Or you just you get a sense of where you are. You know, even if they're in three different locations, you know, you still get it like, oh, I turned this corner from the stairs, I'm in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Or I run in between these houses, now I'm in the street, there's the Doyle house, there's the Wallace house. Yeah. Like, it's awesome.
It's interesting. They also make silencers like a big deal too. Bishop talks about it's like this cutting edge technology, but you and I, you know, silencers are everywhere in movies now.
Or, Nancy Loomis, Julie, I think her character is, she's like, why aren't there any sounds?
Oh yeah.
And
yeah,
he's like, exactly. Silencers.
Yeah. Yeah. Where they shoot at the police station. That goes on for like 5 minutes. That's the They Live fight sequence of shootouts. Yeah. Nonstop, him taking shots. Glass getting knocked out. It was great, man. It goes on for forever. I'd be interested see which is longer, when they mow down the forest and Predator, or the shootout, station shootout in Precinct 13. It's long.
Well, even when the shooting gallery of Cholos start coming in, I want to say that's not even as long as the initial shootout of the precinct.
Yeah. Carpenter edited this movie. Did you see that he had to credit himself as a John T. Chance, which is the character from Rio Bravo?
There you go. Another Western motif, Howard Hawks.
So, if you see the editor, that
that's really funny. You know what's funny? I, when I saw Deborah Hill's name too, she's script supervisor slash assistant
yeah.
editor.
Yeah. We're going to talk about her more for Halloween, but yeah, I thought that was interesting.
I was kind of like, oh, okay, did I miss the editor? And maybe he had his pseudonym come up after. I don't know, but that's interesting.
Yeah, their barricade they use is the support your local police sign. Another visual comedy to gag to me. The movie had a great sense of humor to it. For this being the calling card for John Carpenter, I think this is a great platform for him to kind of kick off with, because it's everything. It's very tension-filled. It's a showcase of his music, and it's got a great sense of humor. Again, going back to like Hateful Eight and some of the other buddy movies, and I want to say almost like forced buddy movies under life and death situations, those are always a lot of fun, and this one is a blast to start off with. It's
great. It's like a grindhouse western, man. Like we've said, like I made a note here. I was like, if Carpenter had spent his entire career making movies like this, I would have been
all about it.
Well, he even says like he's great at the horror, clearly. But I think it's more like he's great at the suspense, and the horror just serves the suspense. And he's kind of I don't know if he's lamented it, but he's on record as being like, yeah, I didn't want to be horror, but I kind of fell into it, and Halloween was such a success. But honestly, like I said, man, if he had just made nothing but these types of grindhouse style, western type setup movies, I don't know. I mean, I doubt it would have gotten old. Yeah. I would have loved it because, you know, he would have put his own spin on it.
If you're not into horror or sci-fi, more down to earth type of story, and you don't want to get into some of the fantastical type stuff, this is on par a little bit more with Escape from New York. Kind of real grimy, down and dirty, badass. Holian Wilson is very Snake Plissken-ish to me.
His whole like
cool one-liners.
Gotta smoke.
Yeah, smoking. Great. And that's a big thing with Carpenter. He likes a lot of his handsome young lead actor men to be smoking, you know.
Dude, that's so. I love there's so many good dialogue payoffs in this 90-minute movie,
for sure,
that just some you don't have to wait very long for, like when the guy, when they're transforming, knocks him on the back of the head, knocks him out of the chair.
Slip right out of the chair.
Yeah. I don't sit in chairs as well as I used to.
The next scene, he has some banter with Wells.
He don't stand up as good as he used to.
Great.
It's great. And it's both. It's comedy and badass. Let's move on to Halloween from 1978.
The one, the only, the classic Halloween.
I think he'll come back.
Halloween, the night he came home. Rated R.
You mentioned this is your favorite horror film of all time.
My brother and I, when my family got a VCR for the first time, it wasn't just the rentals. Like when we figured out that you could take a blank VHS tape and record something on it, we were like over the moon. Mm-hmm. We're like, oh, and this might be where my love of collecting stuff came about. Because, you know, then we figured out, oh, you can put it on EP mode. Because back then we didn't care about quality. We just wanted to see stuff, you know, like we don't care that it's grainy or pan and scan. I didn't even know what that was when I was a kid.
Right.
So we could squeeze three movies on one tape. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. That means in our whole library, we could have like crazy movies.
So funny.
It's great. And all we were doing was recording stuff off TV. Mm-hmm. That's the first place I experienced Halloween.
You get that V-hold line. It goes
down. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But that's the first place I experienced Halloween was the TV version. So we didn't know anything from cut, uncut, censored, whatever. Later. My parents were like very... They weren't strict, but they were very open with whatever we wanted to watch. If we were with them, it was all good. And they would tell us, close your ears or close your eyes. You know, that's a standard thing across the board for kids. But like when it was off TV, they knew they were good because it was edited down to a safe-ish version. And by and large, it wasn't going to be anything that we, you know, we're like, oh God, running for the hills. Yeah. Even though Halloween, even the TV version, it's freaky, man. Mm-hmm. Like the way he set it up. The way he draws that suspense and really just the setup. Mm-hmm. Same with Assault. There's just like all this setup. And when it finally hits, you're just like, what? You know, you don't even know what's going on. Like, it's, especially as a kid, it's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's actually the version that I prefer, believe it or not.
Oh, interesting.
It's a TV version.
Okay.
Only because it's what I'm used to. It's what I grew up with. We watched it over and over and over.
Right. It's just whatever you're attached to. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter what artistically is better. It's whatever you're attached to. Budget of $325,000. Grosses $47 million.
That's beyond a hit.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Come on. It was, I forget the mathematics of this, but up until The Blair Witch, it was the highest grossing film of all time. If you do the math of what was put into it versus what it made, it was the highest grossing. That math problem, it was the highest grossing film of all time up until The Blair Witch knocked it off the throne. But
that's a crazy amount of time.
Yeah, of course.
It's 20, decades, 21 years?
Something maybe? Like that, yeah.
It's 99
not Blair Witch, Blair Witch, I'll be honest with you. I probably won't ever be doing a review of that one. But one of the things I want to talk about was the amount of movement that we see in this movie. He was using the Panaglide camera. I think a lot of people in this day and age take for granted how much movement is almost expected in movies, almost too much in my opinion sometimes. The fact that we are able to track the three girls down the sidewalks nonstop and watching Dr. Loomis, you're just tracking him through all these different areas. You just hadn't seen movement like that. It was pretty cutting edge technology back then. It still wasn't popular. And I thought that's a real blessing to have that in this movie.
Yeah, let alone the opening.
Oh yeah, one of the most famous Panaglide shots of all time. Yeah. Yeah, of course, it's amazing. There's nothing wrong with getting a little elbow grease into some of your camera shots. Yes, you know that there's someone off camera opening the door, you know, from the POV camera,
changing the lights and stuff. I mean, they do take a long time.
Pan off the naked sister and then come back onto her to with blood with back.
Yeah,
but who gives a fuck? It's cool because if you count the amount of magic tricks on top of the fact that again you're already watching one of the more famous Panaglide shots, so you're watching an all continuous POV shot. That's trick number one. And you see some of your things like the door opening and the blood and the face mask going over at the end of the shot. Yeah, it's great, man. I mean, it's a Rolodex of great in-camera magic tricks. It's awesome. It's totally worth writing about the
crane shot off of that.
Yeah, of course.
The cut with the mask coming off and then it just keeps going. It keeps going. So essentially it's like an extension of that.
He must have been storyboarding that and licking his chops the entire time.
If you watch Assault and look for the, I know we're talking about Halloween, but if you watch for the dollies and the really planned out, pretty slick shots in that movie, they're all over the place.
Yeah, for sure.
There's some really good, like the shot of them coming down the ramp with the down, down, it's awesome walking music, right? Mm-hmm. That whole shot is just one continuous thing. Even when they get to the front and he says, can I stretch my legs or whatever, it's all just one big dolly. Yeah. It's great.
Yeah, it's great.
And Dean Cundey too with Halloween. Cundey like borrowed the lighting scheme from Chinatown. Orange tint for daytime, blue tint for night.
Cundey went on to do what? He did Back to the Future. Did he direct Jurassic Park?
Jurassic Park, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of the most famous DPs of all time.
Sure, he did Halloween 2 and 3. Mm-hmm. He like went beyond Carpenter for that.
Yeah. He had done a couple movies before Halloween. He has a very long standing relationship with Carpenter. And when you think of Carpenter, you think of the look of his films, panoramic cameras, and then Dean Cundey. I mean, it's almost like the peanut butter and jelly, anamorphic lenses and lens flares coming off of like Christine's light bulbs or the flares from The Thing. He has a very specific look, and that's all Cundey. And definitely when we get to The Thing, barely going to be able to talk because I'm drooling over the look of that film. That is his best looking film of all time.
So Cundey did The Thing also?
He did The Thing also, and that is a master. We'll get to it fucking later. I don't know. I won't shut up. But anyways.
No, he's in the Hall of Fame for sure.
He went on to shape the look of some of the most famous movies that you and I and everyone else in the world is familiar with. So, hats off to him. And he pretty much got a star here. You and I are both location nerds. We're going to a different place or a different state. I don't know about you, but I think it's the same. I'm like, oh, hey, I'm flying out to so-and-so. I try to like look and see, do I have an extra day of vacation I can take? So, because I'd love to check out some of these places from some of my favorite movies. And I don't know if I ever told you this, but I went out to California one time and I went
to the street.
Well, here. This is funny. You're not going to believe
it. Where'd you go?
The story goes. So I went to go check out the house from Pee-wee's Big Adventure. I wanted to see Pee-wee's house. I went out to that. As soon as I got the plane, I grabbed the rental car and we drove out to Pee-wee's house. And on the street that the Pee-wee's house was right there. I couldn't get a picture in front of it because they were shooting a Google commercial right in front of the house. So they had it all blocked off. And I was just kind of hanging out with this cop who was running security. I was just kind of hanging out and watching because they had about 50 joggers jogging and they all had these laptops attached to their chest and they were doing jogging. So they had this huge fucking camera rig on top of a car that was driving backwards. And they had 50 joggers typing on these keyboards that were attached to their chest. I've looked for this commercial many times. It's a Google commercial. I never found it. But fuck it anyways. But I was talking to the cop, and I was like, hey, any chance I could? And he's like, no, man, sorry, this is where the whole street shut down. I go, ah, that's a bummer. And literally this cop goes, well, hey, I don't know if you'd be interested, but Laurie Strode's house from Halloween is right there. And I go, what the fuck? And I turned around and it's Laurie Strode's house. So I got my picture taken, you know, where she sits on the stoop with the with the pumpkin. So for me now, I know, and in my head, I'm loving the fact that Laurie Strode and Pee Wee Herman are, right, are next door neighbors. Yeah. So I thought that was really fucking cool. So
anyways. Strode Realty sold him that house. Great I'm going to need you to drop a key by the Rubens. House, yeah.
That's great. Yeah.
Not to mix his real
persona. The sprinklers come on and get her all away. Yeah, terrible. Yeah.
That's what I was going to ask in the commercial. But could you see the house at all?
I never found the commercial.
Like, while you were there, were you in eyesight at least to the house?
Oh, like, yeah. So literally the street they were jogging down, I was on side A and Pee Wee's house was on side B, and I couldn't cross because there was these joggers and they had a whole
Did they have set. It like tricked out like Pee Wee's front yard? No, with all the weird stuff?
Oh, sorry. I apologize. Let me rephrase the whole fucking story. The house looks completely different now. So yes, it just happened to be that Pee Wee shot there whoever, or Tim Burton or whatever. But yeah, so I just
my mind was running away. I was like, oh, the Google commercial all oriented around Pee Wee's place.
Right. No, I would have totally Googled Pee Wee's house, Google commercial. But no, I kept typing in like Google joggers and I never found the commercial. And I was kind of bummed because I was like,
it's cool that you saw the Strode house.
Yeah, that was cool.
Did you ever go to the street where the Wallace and the Doyle houses?
No, I didn't go to that one. I've been to the Nightmare House and I've been to a couple of like
the Nightmare House. Is somewhere there too. But in fact, you know about that story, right? The carpenter inserts.
The house got moved down the street or something like that.
Well, the Myers house, they relocated it.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It's like a business.
That's the same thing with the Texas Chainsaw Massacre house. I don't know if you knew that.
Really?
They lifted it up and put it in a whole new location because I went and saw that house when I was in Texas.
And it wasn't in the same field.
And I had to track it down because it's not in the original location.
Crazy. Yeah, I've heard that the business... It's like a business place where there's like four suites that you can rent in the Myers house.
Oh, that's cool.
And they have to have signs up saying, do not approach the porch because people are working
here. Oh, that's so interesting.
They're not like a-holes about it, but at the same time, they're like, please keep your distance. I meant when they brought Carpenter back with the crew for Halloween 2 to film the extra scenes to make up for what they cut for the first movie, which is the TV version or whatever. The house that's supposed to be Laurie's house that Linda comes over in that extra scene, that's the interior of the Nightmare on Elm Street house.
Oh, okay. I did know that. Yes.
Yeah. So they're actually inside that house. It's always fascinated me.
That's
crazy, like, connection.
You know, there's a scene where Loomis is making the phone call at a payphone that's out in the middle of fucking nowhere.
Again, there you go. There's another.
But the fact that they timed out that shot exactly for that huge train to come by that exact moment. Now, how often do trains come by? But the fact that you can add that, just that little bit of production value, that could have been a very plain shot without a train rumbling through. But just the fact that they were able to either coordinate or whatever, it's free. But it adds production value. I just think that's kind of cool.
And he does those types of tricks. The sound too. Now, granted, the music comes in when he finds the matchbook.
Right.
But you also have that like churning, like sound of the train, and maybe even the whistle. You just have this constant noise right when he's discovering this stuff, and he doesn't even see the body.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Only we get to see that. Yeah. And he takes off because he just knows. I've always loved that.
Yeah, like, I thought that was
never
cool.
Finds that too. But yeah, you're right, man. That train coming by.
Yeah.
He had to have sat there, and
it could have been a flat shot, but then that's a beautiful shot. Now you have a train going by and it keeps the shot interesting. I just thought it was kind of cool. He's good at doing that type of stuff. And I love noticing those things. Let's talk about Deborah Hill. So that they keep working even when he married Adrienne Barbeau. And if so, is that,
I was about to say that. I wonder if, I'll be honest with you, I didn't see when they...
We might have to research this for episodes 2, 3, 4, 5, 17.
Yeah. So I don't know if they were still together or not, or if they were, and he was just like, oh, look at...
That's because that's awkward.
Stevie Ray.
Yeah. K-A-B or something. That's funny.
He's behind the camera. Whoa.
But yeah, Deborah Hill was a very powerful female producer, even way back then. She ended up producing Fisher King, which I love.
Nice.
That's a good movie.
I know she contributed to a lot of the girls' dialogue
in Halloween. Yes.
So it made it feel more natural, they say. That's the lore.
Yeah, I've heard Jamie Lee Curtis actually say that, so that's cool.
Yeah.
And I think she was giving Deborah Hill a lot of credit for like the fact that it took place on Halloween was Deborah Hill's idea. So that scene where Loomis is going to the grave site, and that guy is just rambling.
I remember over in Russellville, on Charlie Bowles, about 15 years ago. One night he finished dinner, and he excused himself from the table, and he went out to the garage, and he got himself a hacksaw. And then he went back into the house, and he kissed his wife and his two children goodbye, and then he proceeded...
Where are we?
Oh, it's right over here.
Old Charlie Bowles over in Russellville.
He's like, interrupts him. He's like, where are we? And I just thought, it's a perfect scene moment too. So funny.
He then proceeded to, where are we? Yeah, so good. It's great. He got himself a hacksaw. Oh, God, that guy's delivery. Do you know who that is?
No.
Like, for good or ill, I will never forget who this guy is. Hook, the Spielberg movie about Peter Pan with Robin
Williams.
You're
going to hate me for this. I've never seen it.
You've never seen it? Okay.
I've heard.
This is why I said
not good things.
Yeah, that's why I said for good or ill, because it has its followers and it really has its detractors. Okay. Like, people hate that movie. I'm one of those that really enjoy the movie.
Okay.
It's not the greatest movie in the world, but it's got, you know, it's got its moments. But there's a guy in it. It's that guy. It's the grave, the caretaker. And he plays this guy. He's older because it's like 91. So it's, you know, it's at least 12 years past, give or take. I'm not going to do the math here because now I've built it up. But anyway, he's an old dude and his name is Toodles. He's like lost his marbles. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's cheese ball. You know, this is
what, I will check out Hook.
Wait a minute. I'm starting to realize I hate the movie. No, I'm just kidding. No. No,
description is really selling me.
That guy he's not as funny in Hook, but it's just like when you see somebody from something else in something you've seen 1,000 times and you've never put it together, it's like, for some reason, that's always stuck with me.
Yeah.
So I'm always like, hey, it's a guy from Hook, Charlie Bowles.
But just seeing it this past screening, I was like, I was fucking dying. Like, I forgot how funny. I guess I never really picked up on the humor of that. And just he's just rambling. And just the fact that Loomis, who never had really kind of any kind of funny line at all in that whole movie, like nothing. And that was great that he entered. He's like, what?
That just, funny interaction. Know, although I do like it when he yells at the kid.
Oh, but
hey,
that was
Lonnie.
Yeah. I guess he did have that line.
Of course, he's so proud of it too. Yeah, he leans back.
One of the other things I wanted to move on to was the Charles Cypher.
Sheriff Brackett. Okay.
So the scene where they roll up on him and he's there at the hardware store.
Hey, stop coughing. What's the matter with you? Just be natural. There he is. Just be natural for him.
Hi, Annie. Laurie.
Hi, Dad. What happened?
What?
What happened?
Oh, somebody broke into the hardware store. Probably kids.
You blame everything on kids.
Well, now all they took was some Halloween mask, a rope, and a couple of knives. Who do you think it was?
He gives this description of items that were stolen, and he's so blasé about it. He's like, well, it was Halloween mask, rope, and a couple knives. It was acting like it was so no big deal, but I remember thinking, like, what the? Jesus, that should really be sparking someone's attention. That's red flag right there.
Hey, couple of knives.
Knives, masks, and a rope. That's a starter
also
kit right there.
Also some handcuffs, maybe some hydrochloric acid was gone. No big deal. They stole a GIMP mask and a trunk. I don't know.
God.
A couple of innocent kids. There's a meme of Sheriff Brackett, and it's like, how is he supposed to find a killer on the loose when he can't even tell when his daughter was smoking a joint?
Right,
something?
I mean, she had just done it too, man.
Right there.
Yeah, yellow joints. That was always, I don't know why that color of that joint always stuck out to me.
That's another thing. The TV version that I'm used to.
Okay.
Edits that out, not that whole scene, but every time they pass it, because of pan and scan, they were able to cut around that, which is really interesting to me. But it always it. I wish I could find that tape somewhere that I have of it, because it would be so funny to hear how choppy the music would be in the background Carpenter's band and then Don't Fear the Reaper playing in the back. Which, by the way, how did they get that song?
Yeah, no kidding on that budget.
Yeah, it's like, what?
No kidding. I'm positive that Peter Jackson paid way more for it later on down the line for Frighteners or something. Tommy yelling that he saw the boogeyman.
There's no boogeyman, and if you don't stop all this, I'm going to have to turn off the TV and send you to bed.
Did he not want to, you know, throw in the fact that, also he's carrying the dead babysitter's body?
I think your friend that was just here in the same house.
You want to mention that? Yeah. Like, you just saw
it out
the window?
Lifeless corpse is being traipsed around
I know.
my my friend's house. Yeah. That's pretty funny. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because she was just in that house.
I know. But you just want to maybe just give a more immediate attention. Like, hey, I just saw the boogeyman. I'm not making shit up. He's carrying your friend around. Yeah. Like, so Linda and Bob, they stop having sex when the phone rings. They take the phone off the hook. I don't think they hung up on him. You know, I mean, they just took it off the hook and then they start having sex. And 10 seconds later, she says, fantastic. Yeah. Like, I was like, oh my God, that was like the quickest.
That's Bob, man.
Yeah. That's just wham, bam. Like, oh man, that's crazy.
Oh, by the way, I have to tell you, I read the novelization of this.
This movie?
Yeah, the script novelization. And the reason I'm bringing it up now is because, okay, first of all, it's the craziest shit you'll ever read. The weirdest thing. And it's like an alternate reality. When Michael is watching Bob and Linda, I guess this is me circling back to what you were talking about. When he's watching Bob and Linda have sex, he feels this like pulsing. Like seriously, there's purple prose about Bob and Linda having sex. Like all this stupid romance novel prose that doesn't make any sense in the horror story that it is. And Michael feels this like stirring in his loins. I was like, what is this? Whoa. Yeah, I was like, weird. What? Number one, I don't need to know about Michael Myers' loins.
Yeah. That's
secondly,
crazy.
That shouldn't be what motivates him. It's scarier when it's not explained.
Yeah, of course.
Which is where
that's why the guy's called The Shape.
Exactly.
He does that a lot in a lot of his movies. You don't need backstory. I don't need it. He's real good at just dropping you in the middle of the maze.
Yeah.
He'll lead you out. But you don't need exposition and a lot of setup.
And even, I mean, I've heard complaints about the first Halloween not really being plot driven. And I'm like, you don't need a plot.
That's the scariest part.
Yeah. You're dropped into it.
The randomness.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He had no attention to Jamie Lee Curtis at all. So we already talked about the name over the title. That was a big thing for him. He had grown up with other directors that he idolized doing that. And I don't know if a lot of directors do it now. I know. I think Tarantino does it and maybe a couple others. But that's really him saying, hey, I take full responsibility. My name's going over to Marquee. And again, that goes back to his branding. Halloween was the first.
He does enough. You know, in the process, I mean, if he's helping out, I mean, maybe he's not editing certain movies, but I'm sure he's right there in the room.
But it's his. It's ultimately his vision.
Yeah, the writing, the score, the directing, I mean, for sure.
Dr. Loomis is named after Sam Loomis from Psycho, which has the Jamie Lee Curtis attachment there.
Even the nurse is Marion.
Kyle Richards, who plays Lindsay, niece of Paris Hilton.
And I think sister of the girl killed in Assault.
Oh, get out of here. Because
it's Kim Richards.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's her. Kim Richards. And then Kyle Richards. Yeah. And she's a real housewife, too. Oh, she's coming back to play Lindsay Wallace.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah. That's kind of one reason I want to bring that. That's kind of cool. Tony Moran. That's Aaron Moran's. Joni Cunningham from The Happy Days Show. Did you know that's her brother?
No. You're talking about the guy who plays Michael with the mask
off? 5 seconds. Yeah. So there's three people who played, technically. Okay, so there's Nick Castle, who played him most of the time. And then there was someone else, I believe. And then when he lifts his mask up for 5 seconds, it's an actor named Tony Moran. And that's Aaron Moran's brother.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah,
that is crazy.
Yeah, I know. Carpenter was paid $10,000 for writing, directing, and scoring, plus 10 points of the profit. I don't know the math on $47 million, but...
That was smart.
Yeah.
That was smart.
That's a real that's a real gamble on yourself, but it paid off.
That's like Lucas being like, give me some of that merchandise.
Yeah,
like,
come on, exactly.
That's really smart.
Because that's how Lucas became the bazillionaire that he was. He didn't have so much power over the movies at the time, but he said, give me the merchandising rights, and no one was doing merchandising back then. People didn't understand.
They thought, whatever, take it.
Yeah, who's going to buy toys? Fucking big mistake. So, yeah.
Just look at what dropped recently on Disney Plus. They did the vintage Star Wars set with the two... seasons of Clone Wars, the animated micro series, and then a couple of things, the Ewok stuff. Anyway, the design of that page on Disney Plus looks just like the Kenner toys.
That's awesome.
even today it holds up. It's
I've been going
strong.
On Disney Plus a lot. I won't get too much into this, but I gotta be honest with you, I'm not a huge Marvel fan, but my kid is obsessed right now, and we are going through all the Marvel movies, and I am having the time of my life because I have been struggling to get my child into watching movies, my most favorite thing in the world to do. And now that she's obsessed with Marvel movies, I mean, before she even wakes up and has breakfast, she says, can we start watching that movie again? And I'm like,
sure.
I'm in pajamas and it's 8 o'clock in the morning and this kid wants to rip open this home theater and just turn it up to full blast.
Dude, if that's the gateway, cool.
And it's a gateway for me because now I'm like, I'm having such a good time watching Marvel movies. Anyway, so
if you come out the other side and you're like, you know, these movies are kind of fun.
Yeah, all right. Well, you know what? It's all about experiences. And if I remember the Marvel movies for the times I have with my kid, then I'm probably going to end up being a pretty big Marvel fan. So we'll see what happens.
Our screens went to sleep at the same time.
I think they're in their same cycles.
I don't know. Uh-oh, we're starting to gel here.
Yeah, exactly. No.
Same cycles. Okay, I just got it.
Sorry. That was terrible.
Shame what are we, on a me. Sleepaway camp? Yeah. Oh, that's next time. No.
So, before we move on to The Fog, you already touched base on the TV version. Do you have any highs or lows or standout points for the sequels or the reboot or anything? Like, is there anything?
The Halloween franchise?
Any recommendations or is anything you kind of touched base on?
Well, here's the main thing that I love. If you just want an overview, like, sure. I love watch I'll go on for 10 minutes. No, just kidding. Spit take. Bleh. No. I love that Halloween as a franchise is like a choose your own adventure series.
That's true.
Like, you can watch it all the way through if you want, and it'll make zero fucking sense. Mm-hmm. Or you can split it up and it'll still make zero. No, I'm just kidding. Mm-hmm. But like, you can watch the first one and be done. First one standalone, great ending. Don't need anything else. Mm-hmm. Not even the 2018 one, even though I really enjoy that movie. Mm-hmm. You can watch one and two. That has an ending that's pretty definite until they made four.
Yeah.
Because three. Okay, there's also Outliers. Mm-hmm. I've thought about this. There's there's Outliers 3, Halloween Resurrection, and the two Rob Zombie movies are kind of in their own little world, minus the cold open of Resurrection. Mm-hmm. So, okay, that's two different ways. The third way, like the Outliers is third. The fourth way, you could do 1, 2, 4, 5, 6, because that tells like a blood relative story kind of from beginning to end. 6 has got the alternate cut. You know, whatever you prefer, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then you got H2O, which kind of, but really doesn't work with 4, 5, 6. I'd like to think you cannot, because it makes Laurie into a terrible mother, faking her own death and leaving her daughter to be terrorized. Like, it's makes no sense. Mm-hmm. So I would say that belongs with 1, 2 and H2O. That's a pretty cool trilogy.
Okay.
And if you want to go dark, the cold open of Resurrection has Laurie dying.
Right. Okay.
By Myers' hand. So you could be like, well, if you just want to be a depressing, like, evil wins thing, right, watch that cold open and then stop it, because Resurrection's a pile of shit.
Right. Right.
Or if you want a good laugh and you want Busta Rhymes coming in and effing up the whole franchise, then fine, go for it. But it has its, you know, laughter moments. Mm-hmm. Or the new one, watch 1, watch 2018.
Okay.
And then that makes a little story. And then, of course, they're making the other sequels.
And then one quick touch base on the Rob Zombie versions.
Oof. The first one.
Okay.
Watchable.
Okay. Quick question.
Yeah.
Theatrical or director's cut?
Theatrical.
Correct.
Yes. Yes. There wasn't a question there.
Which version do you prefer, theatrical or directors, and why is it theatrical?
Theatrical because, number one, it's just any time less spent in that world is great for me.
Oh, wow. Rough.
Just because it's just, you know, Rob Zombie, love him, hate him. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm middle of the road. Mm-hmm. I enjoy some of his stuff. I haven't seen his whole body of work.
I'm in the middle. I'll be honest with you. And this is me being transparent. He's waning on me.
Really?
So I'll just put it there.
Well,
but anyways.
3 from Hell was a little bit like, why was this made?
Well, I'll tell you, his sequel to his own Halloween remake is, for me, that was the spiral that was starting to get a little out of control.
You and a lot of other people like blasted that movie so much that I specifically didn't go see it. Mm-hmm. The first time I ever watched it was when I got that Scream Factory box set.
Gotcha. Did that have two different versions of that one?
No, that's the thing. Zombie doesn't want the theatrical cuts of those movies out there. The only place you can find it.
But there is two cuts though, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think you can get the theatrical digitally of the second one, but only pretty recently. And I bought the theatrical of the first Zombie Halloween on digital specifically because the only other way to get it was DVD. And I was like, if I'm going to slog through a zombie movie, a Rob Zombie movie, although I shouldn't say that because I really do. I think you don't need the Myers stuff as a kid. Mm-hmm. You don't need to show him from some dysfunctional family where William Forsythe is yelling
at obscenities. Sorry to interrupt you. It goes against a little bit what we were talking about only 5 minutes ago where you don't need backstory.
Yeah.
And that is not.
Plus, it's kind of like it's a lame backstory.
I didn't hear his score for it. I mean, his music's always pretty good. Yeah. And it keeps the energy up. I remember when Michael Myers breaks out of jail and in the director's cut, doesn't it get a little rapey?
The guards, those two guys, bring in a girl.
Okay.
Maybe a female prisoner, which is also very problematic. Man. No, you don't need it.
He was more of a superhero-ish when he breaks out. Because I think he just busts the chains, if I'm not mistaken, which,
and
you
I
know,
think,
whatever.
I think they show him the female mental patient just to be like, oh, look at this Mikey or whatever. Mm-hmm. But in the director's cut, they bring the girl into his cell. And it's too much. But that's the thing about Rob Zombie stuff, man. It's like everything's so filthy. Just filthy to be filthy. I find the first one watchable. The second one, I think you
first
guys
watchable.
You guys built the second one down so much that when I watched it, I was like, "Yeah," but that's not a good reaction to have.
But
to
which
a movie.
Version did you watch?
The unrated director's cut.
Yeah,
and I was just like,
don't quote me. I believe the theatrical and director's cut are vastly different.
Oh yeah, it's like they're like, I want to say it's like 20 minutes.
Okay. Well, the version
difference,
I
which
saw
is crazy, like
really turned me off.
Yeah. Well, I don't love it. I don't love it. I've only seen it the one time. I didn't go back and revisit it.
Moving on to our last movie, 1980's The Fog.
11:55. Almost midnight. Enough time for one more story. 5 minutes. It'll be the 21st of April. It is told by the fishermen and their fathers and grandfathers that when the fog returns to Antonio Bay, the men at the bottom of the sea rise up.
You got any initial thoughts about this one?
Just I love the creepiness of it. Mm-hmm. Like I love the ghost story aspect of it, the pirate aspect of it, which you don't really get right away.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of are strong. I mean, you do and you don't. Like, I love the setup.
Mm-hmm.
Carpenter's basically telling you the movie at the beginning.
Right.
But if you're watching it for the first time or if you haven't seen it in a while, you don't really know that or you don't remember it. Mm-hmm. But you're getting everything you need to know about what's going on. Right there with John Houseman.
Right.
My God, it was a fire. Yeah. It's like the best. Yeah. I love that line. But just the ghost story aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
The 4K looks great.
Yeah, I agree.
I love it. I saw it semi recently.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first movie I popped in. I mean, that shows you, maybe it's not my favorite of the bunch, but man, I just really love, I love the movie.
It's a fun movie. I will say, in my honest opinion, out of the three, it's probably the weaker of the three. He wasn't always 100% happy with this. I'm sure you heard about a lot of reshoots for this one. That scene you were just talking about was a complete reshoot, and it's actually probably the best looking scene in the whole movie. So, because they probably had a little more time to light it. But
I wonder, that's probably why they were told to go back and do it then, so that it's like, explain a little bit of this right out of the gate.
Yeah, that first scene's a reshoot. He's credited with Halloween as starting that type of genre.
I'd say I'd put Psycho as the godfather.
Yeah.
Maybe say Halloween is the push that the genre needed.
Possibly, yeah.
Because it did start a wave
of
repeat offenders.
Mm-hmm. Some we love, some we don't. Freddy, Jason,
look at Friday the 13th, the first one. They basically were like, we need to make another Halloween.
Yeah.
And so they just kind of
My Bloody Valentine. It's just like all these. Location. Everyone had to have a gimmick or a mask or something like that.
So a lot of those I really like, though, I got to say.
Yeah, of course. Dude, I grew up on that shit.
I just saw My Bloody Valentine for the first time very recently.
Have you seen the remake?
No.
Okay. No. I believe it's Tom Atkins, too.
Oh, are you serious?
I think he's
Well, that kind of makes me want to watch just to be like. Ooh.
It's from the guys who did that Nicolas Cage, Amber Heard movie. Drive Angry.
Patrick Lussier or whatever his name is.
Yeah, it's not great.
Well, I mean, I might give it a shot.
No, dude, please don't. Yeah. Anytime I'm telling you, man, like, don't let me stop you. Halloween 2, the Rob Zombie version.
The 3D version, of course. I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
No, I will say, like, I actually watched the original My Bloody Valentine on Shudder, I think. Mm. I think it was up on Shudder. But then I heard that Scream Factory had released the version that had all the cut gore back into it.
Yeah.
And I was like, well,
I heard
they're
doing a new cut of that.
Yeah, so I had a little money and I got that.
Oh, nice.
That's very recently. So I watched the original cut, theatrical. Mm-hmm. Then I watched that a bit, and man, it makes a huge difference.
Right.
And it's more than just
a transfer.
Oh, it looks really good.
Oh, nice.
It looks great. Like, it's much more of a difference between the theatrical of Friday the 13th and the uncut Friday the 13th,
gotcha.
Where they just add a few seconds to each kill. So you see Tom Savini's work, and even that makes a big difference. This is way beyond that. It's like they linger with stuff, and you're just like, oh my god. Oh,
cool, cool, cool.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. Great to check out. Mm.
You know, the irony is that, you know, with the reshoots, Carpenter got to the end of the first edit and was like, this isn't violent enough. And it's funny because he knew he was having to compete with the movies that were basically ripoffs of Halloween. He really was okay with originally just doing kind of a ghost story. And then he got to the end, and the movies had gotten to a certain level at that point when The Fog came out in the early 80s. So he was like, well, now I got to compete with the shit that basically I created, you know? So I thought that was kind of funny.
Yeah.
Jumping way ahead on this. I'm going to be all over this. Dude, that is a killer last shot, man. I love the priest getting axed down with the pirates. I thought that was just and just cut to hard black, yeah. And then credits roll. Man, that is just a dope ending.
The shot, man. All the lead up to that too, where they're all spaced throughout the auditorium of the church or the rectory, yeah. Or whatever. Like, that is insane. And the light, like the lights they have over their eyes or whatever, the red.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I love that last shot, man. I just talked about Planet of the Apes on one of the earlier episodes I did. And when you can do like a mic drop of a last shot like that, like, hey, that's how we're going out to black. Like, that is a cool way to leave the theater, you know, knocking off the spilled popcorn off your chest and be like, man, what a great way to end that movie. You know, it seems like, you know, you come out with a big smile on that. And we talked about earlier about, you know, Charles Cyphers playing Dan O'Bannon.
The Carpenter Players.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. They all get these like funny names. Tom Atkins plays Nick Castle.
Nick Castle, yeah, that's right.
So yeah, it's a funny thing he does. That guy who pops up in a couple of his other movies, George Buck. I think he was like a bum in Escape from New York. Oh, George Buck, I believe in They Live. He was the guy at the end of the movie. Yeah, he was in a nice suit, and he's like, oh, aren't you enjoying all the riches of, you know, being in the spaceship?
God, I can't wait to watch that again.
Yeah, it's gonna be great. 4K too.
Yes,
it's gonna be awesome. But his character's name is Tommy Wallace. So yeah, I mean, he does that a lot with his movies.
He named one of the guys in The Fog Tommy Wallace.
Yes,
like Tommy Doyle and Lindsay Wallace. He just
Oh, that's funny.
It's like this next movie's. He's combining, he's like just Yahtzee shaking it up. All right, what do we got? Ooh, Tommy Wallace. Exactly, that's great.
When was the last time you watched The Fog?
When I got that 4K set. Okay. So pretty fairly recently. Okay. A few months ago,
dude,
probably.
Those opening kills on the boat, God, those are violent, man. It's great. Like, brutal.
Plus
stuff.
The atmosphere of it. Like when that guy, and maybe it's George Buck you're talking about, like when he's like, oh my God, that weird whisper voice he does. And then that awesome shot up the mast of the ghost pirate ship with all the fog swirling around it. Love that shot.
Yeah,
and it's juxtaposed with the modern boat too. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's just cool. Great ideas.
And the score's great too, of course.
Dude, his score in The Fog is like, I don't want to say that it's better than the Halloween score to me, because that one is pretty iconic. But that simple arpeggio sort of, it's the closest Carpenter came to doing Philip Glass.
Yeah,
just a very minimalist thing. And then that piano motif, that's just the chords.
Yeah,
and then it's
great.
Awesome.
He does
awesome.
Great with the atmosphere, but I gotta tell you, the ramp up during some of the more actiony type sequences towards the end is so fantastic. It gets your heart beating, and it's a great.
He leans into that like,
it's awesome.
The synthesizer king.
It's great. Yeah, exactly. Kind of cool that the Coupe de Villes made an audio appearance in this movie. Carpenter's band that he plays in is
Nick Castle.
Nick Castle's in it,
and Tommy Lee Wallace.
You know, we've talked about this. 2.35 looked really good on this movie. The widescreen aspect ratio out of the three movies we reviewed tonight, I would say it looked the best with The Fog. This movie is very heavy on landscape shots and seeing the fog tumble in and stuff like that. And just the lineup of the pirates, which, side note, I will tell you, it wasn't until two screenings ago of this movie that I must have missed it. This was a group of lepers.
Yes.
That was a quick line in the storytelling by the priest. And I guess I must have missed it in some of my previous screenings, and it wasn't until I really was paying attention and I was like, oh, that's kind of grim.
They're like leper pirates.
Yes.
It's real weird.
But that would make sense, you know, peg legs and all hooks and all kinds of shit.
And that's the
but...
conspiracy angle, because they're sequestered away and they're isolated.
Yeah.
And they're supposed to be getting help from the clergy or whatever. And I mean, spoiler. No.
Yeah.
They're supposed to be getting help, and they take the money and don't do a thing with it, or make the cross, I guess.
It's almost kind of like the townspeople who didn't want, almost like the burn victim type. It was almost kind of like a Freddy Krueger type thing, except for these guys were kind of innocent at the time. They just wanted a place to land. And so when you kind of dive into some of the backstory of why these guys are coming back for revenge, you're like, well, I don't blame them kind of question.
Well, that's why when Hal Holbrook as the father, like when he realizes it, he's so good because he's barely in the movie. Barely.
Yeah.
Like, they probably had him for like just a handful of days, and that's it.
Yeah.
But he plays it so great because he's so humiliated and he's so like just downtrodden about it. But there's nothing he can do.
Yeah.
And so he's just like, ugh. And so that's what makes it pretty awesome when they come back, because he's like realizes, wait, they're supposed to be sick, sort of. And then,
What do we think of Carpenter as an actor?
Oh God, I know he hates it.
I'm all through, Father. Oh, thank you, Bennett. I won't need you until 4 tomorrow, Bennett.
Yes, sir.
Would you like something to keep you warm on the way home?
No, thank you. Father, can I get paid?
I'm done with my work. Can I get paid and leave? Like, God.
You can't not recognize that mustache anywhere, you know, so you know it's
the hair. He's had the same look
for decades. There's an old, I'm going to get a little heavy metal on you here for a second. I used to go see Henry Rollins. He used to do like a stand-up tour all the time.
Yeah.
And it was great. If you ever get the chance, I highly recommend it, whether you're a fan of his music.
Was it his music or just his spoken word stuff?
It's his spoken word stuff. And it is, he never comes in with a script. So it's right off the top of his head. And he goes on for 3 hours nonstop. And it's like, cool. He doesn't even take a breath. He goes the whole time telling stories, and it's great. He tells great stories about, you know, fighting Al Pacino in Heat and like all kinds of like rad shit.
Oh, that's kind of cool. I forgot he was that dude.
He's got some great stories, man. It's fantastic. But one of the things he talks about is he talks about the group Slayer, and he says, you know, the thing about Slayer is that after every album, they just put them in a time capsule and then unfreeze them when it's ready to, because their music has never changed. They are straight Slayer. They are straight 80s thrash metal throughout their entire career. They've never changed with the times. He has this theory that they go into some kind of cryo chamber in between each album, and they don't know that it's, you know, we've evolved into whatever music. So they're the exact same. Carpenter throughout his entire career, man. He's just chain smoking, mustache wearing, ponytail, badass motherfucker.
That's
man.
Great.
And I love it.
It's true.
He's never changed.
Me and a friend of mine, like what I said earlier about him looking more like David Lopan now in human form. Yeah. Like we've said that for years now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's even more
alive,
now.
Man. He's the Keith Richards of directors. Dude, he's awesome.
I love his, he just does not give a shit.
He doesn't. He really doesn't.
Which is funny because if you look back at his, this is a ultimate sidetrack. But like when you get, like if you look at his early interviews, he almost plays it too cool.
Yeah.
He's like Mr. like, oh, yeah, whatever. Yeah, yeah. Cool. Now he's like, I don't give a shit.
Right. Yeah.
And it's really funny that he evolved from a little aloof and too cool to who cares.
He's made his mark. He hasn't made a movie in years. And I saw an interview recently where they were asking him about does he like the remakes of his movies? And he said, well, I got two different kinds of remakes. There's remakes like The Thing remake. They didn't consult him. He doesn't get screenwriting credit. He doesn't get any money for it. And then he says, well, look, then there's movies that I don't even watch, like The Fog remake, where I get paid for being the writer because it's technically based on my story. So I didn't do any work and I just put my hand out and money appears. He goes, I'll do that type of remaking all day long. It's funny to listen to, but also like, man, this dude doesn't give a shit. He's a legend. He knows he's put his mark, his stamp on the world of cinema, and he doesn't really need to do anything.
Yeah. Have you seen the Scanners Criterion Blu-ray?
There's a
special feature on there that is
where the three people, there's like him and Landis.
Yeah, Mick Garris is interviewing the three of them. And dude, Carpenter, that's where he kind of comes off the most aloof that I've seen of his earliest stuff. And John Landis, who I think had just done American Werewolf in London, he's calling him out on like several things. And it is kind of cringy, but really funny because Mick Garris is like, you know what? Does this kind of thing scare you? Mm-hmm. You know, like being stalked or whatever. And he's just like, no, not a lot scares me. No. But then later in the interview, he says something like, oh man, that really terrified me. So blah, blah, blah. And Landis is like, so you do get terrified.
Right,
okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he says something else later. Mm-hmm. And Landis is like, all right, so that's two things you said. It's so funny.
I've been to some Q&As of his. I've met him.
Carpenter?
I think I met him twice. I've been to some Q&As with him. You know, I will say the second Q&A I went to him, I think he was maybe in a bad mood, but he was nonstop talking about just getting paid. It was getting to a point where I was like, this isn't that interesting. He just kept talking about it. And I will say at one point, about 45 minutes in this Q&A, someone's cell phone went off in the audience, and it was the Halloween theme. And he stood up and he goes, hey, you owe me money. That was pretty fucking funny. But at the same time, like, he's talking about money again. But whatever, it doesn't matter. I don't give a shit. He's the man. Dude, there is a lot of drinking and driving in this movie. Like, a lot. Like, Vince Neil amounts, you know? Like,
Tom Atkins' like first foray into, like, or maybe it was Halloween. No, Halloween 3 was after The Fog, wasn't it?
This is 80, so whenever
Halloween 2 came out. Yeah, it was, The Fog was before it. So, yeah, that might have been his first little bit into God. Being more of a stud than he probably should
yeah,
be.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, Jamie Lee Curtis looks like maybe a third of his age. And Jamie Lee Curtis has always been gorgeous.
Yeah.
And Atkins is, he just looks seasoned, though. I'll put it that way.
Yeah. Bringing up the can of Bud
yeah,
like after he picks her up.
5 seconds like, picking her up. Yeah. That's just a lot of drinking.
You might say that his brain is in a fog.
Adrian Barbeau, towards the end of the movie, when the fog's coming in and everyone's getting killed and murdered, you know you're in some desperate times when you're giving out the address to your child's house saying, anyone, please come pick up my kid. You know you're in desperate times when you're putting that over the radio waves. Like, that's cut the definition.
Cut to Atkins wrenching the steering wheel, pulling like crazy.
Just drinking and driving. Yeah, you know, here, I'll go pick up your kid. Like, holy crap.
That's right. That's funny. I forgot she drops
came from
the
a
address.
Fresh brewery or something like that. You know, I can't say that word, by the way, brewery. I don't know. Just to finish off on the score, man, I got to say, it's a great ghost story. And not just to be a Carpenter completist, it's just a good movie to watch. But I will definitely say the highlight is the score.
Yep.
I feel like the score really kind of kept this movie going and moving forward. So I thought it was one of the best storytelling vehicles in the movie.
I will say second to the score. Cause I agree with you on the score. Second to the score, just the way it shot, the way he, you're talking about the widescreen earlier.
You're right.
The way he kind of just singles out areas within that frame to show us action. Like, there's so much darkness shrouding that frame that it's just, it's awesome. It's like the whole movie is in a, you know, there's a fog creeping in, even though when it does creep in, it's glowing and you can clearly tell when it's about to be on you. But like, I just love how you have to kind of look into the corners of the movie. Like, what am I seeing over there? And then when the attack does happen, it's just bright as hell and you're squinting your eyes and you can really, the 4K shines in those. I mean, it shines with the blacks, but it really shines when the difference happens and that light kicks in. It's just like, it's,
I will also say I can't even say this word, but anyways, the title character of the fog.
Yes.
The titular, I can never say that word. I think
fog.
I screwed it up on another podcast too. I should stay fog. So clear.
What you're saying
word.
Is fog is the tits.
Yeah.
No.
yeah, it's the best. No. But the titular character is so beautifully lit by Cundy. And we're going to get into this more with when we get to the thing, because there was a little bit of a clash between Botine and Cundy. You know, so
I don't know if I've heard of that. Yeah. I'm going to look that up. I want to hear about it first.
Yeah, I mean, it's no big deal. We'll talk about it later. In this movie, he does a great job. The shadows are your friend. You know, he's doing low budget movies at night. You got to cut cost, it's going to be in the lighting department. You know what I mean? And they're doing fast setups too. So it's guerrilla filmmaking. But I would say the first three of his movies are just really dark and shadows. It's definitely a character in each one of the movies, but it in the fog, it's fantastic. The score is the number one, but definitely Cundy like right underneath. But yeah, for sure. Carpenter does a really good job of blocking. He's really good as far as like his shots and framing. They're very cinematic looking, and he knows how to move a camera and he knows how to frame a shot. So I will say that. I know he's working with Cundy as far as the lighting, but he does a really good job of knowing how to frame things a certain way.
Carpenter came out of that film school after Spielberg and De Palma and stuff. So he was kind of at the tail end of that 60s, early 70s era of filmmakers. So he may not have, like you said, he knows how to stretch a dollar. Mm-hmm. He may not have been working with much out of the gate, but there is a shine to it.
Yeah, for
and,
sure.
And so that's, you know, that's kind of what you're talking about too here, where he, you know, he knows his framing. Mm-hmm. He knows that lighting.
Yeah. The Panavision cameras are very shallow depth of field. If you take close up to the face, you can, if you have the tip of the nose in focus, sometimes the eyes are out of focus. Like, that's how shallow the depth of field is on those lenses.
You can tell that in some of that POV Halloween stuff.
Yeah, because some of the outer edges are completely out of focus. Yeah. And then you have a very specific center of focus in the center of the frame.
Deborah Hill's hand coming in as Michael Myers to take that knife. Blurry as hell.
All right, man. So we've pretty much come to the end. Do you have anything else that we didn't touch base on? Is there anything kind of lingering that you wanted to mention?
I kind of came to the realization, like, leading up. I know we were supposed to do this a little bit ago, and so I've had extra time to kind of think about stuff. You mentioned earlier the fantastical element of certain things, Carpenter-wise, and that's kind of like what I think sets him apart from most horror directors. People say master of suspense, master of horror, but really he's kind of the master of the fantasy horror. Not so much with Assault on Precinct 13 or even Escape from New York. Although I think there's a fantasy element of that because the taking Manhattan island itself and making it a prison is like, that's a pretty fantastical idea. And it's, that kind of thing is throughout his movies. Mm-hmm. Big Trouble in Little China is a huge magical fantasy mm-hmm. element to that. Starman, mm-hmm. which is a very mainstream style movie for him, which we'll get to.
Yeah.
Halloween, the fantasy there is the unexplained mm-hmm. force of evil. You know, it's just a lot of that across his movies. And when I kind of realized that, I was like, man, that's everything he does mm-hmm. pretty much.
Is he a Martin Scorsese? Is he an auteur director? No. I would say his movies are elevator pitch movies. You can explain his movies in 30 seconds, and it's got the hooks in me every single time. The most badass hombre in the world, missing an eye, they send him in because the president has been hijacked and is now being held captive in New York, which is now prison, where just the worst villainous personnel in the world have to live and survive, and it's all-out gang warfare. It's crazy. Like, okay, hey, where do I – and who is in it? Kurt Russell, Donald Pleasance, and the taxi cab driver who I'm drawing a blank on.
Isaac. Hayes.
Ernest Borgnine.
Oh, Ernest Borgnine.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
right.
And Isaac Hayes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, where the fuck do I sign up, bro? He always had great posters, too, by the way, side note.
But good taglines for the poster. Yeah, exactly. The night he came home. Yeah. It's like,
He's his own genre, and I love it. So I have one last question. Anybody who has possibly never either seen a John Carpenter movie or somebody who maybe has seen these movies and haven't seen them in a while, not in your opinion, which is the best out of three, but what out of these three movies, which one would you recommend to a first timer?
To a first timer, mm-hmm. Halloween.
Interesting.
Just because it's, to me, mm-hmm. the better of the three.
Gotcha.
Now, the only reason I say it's better than Assault is because it's a different kind of movie than Assault. Mm-hmm. But essentially, the suspense is still there across the board.
Gotcha.
Assault might be more approachable.
I'm going to tell you that I'm going to go with Assault.
Yeah.
Okay. A couple of things from me. Out of the three, you're going to not like this. I think Assault's score is the best. Nice. As much as I love Halloween.
No, I can totally hear you on that.
But there are some rhythms and different tones. And he not only just takes the theme, which is that dun da 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 dun, but it's got, during different scenes, it can go faster or it can go slower, or it can have things added to it where you're like, oh, there's a different drum beat in this version of the theme now. And it's just, it echoes, yeah, yes. And it echoes in my head and it adds tension. So for me, scores are big with me with Carpenter films. Dialogue that worked for me, situations that worked for me, tension. And again, I'm not speaking for myself, which I think is the three best, because I can't even probably pick between the three. But I will say, for me, as far as recommending to a first timer, I would say Assault for me would be the one I'd push.
Nice.
But, hey, dude, you're splitting hairs.
Dude, yeah, I feel like you can't go wrong either way. Yeah. Even with The Fog, I mean, it might not be like on the same level as mm-hmm. Assault and Halloween, but there's still a great movie there and it's just a lot of fun. Plus, I just can't wait to keep plugging along.
Yeah. All right, let's bring it up, man. I'm pretty much at the end here. So again, this is going to be a multiple episode series that we do. We're both in love with Carpenter, and I think we're up for two in a row pretty badass episodes. So
I did look at his
IMDb. Yeah. So like, just give everyone a heads up. On the next episode, we will be reviewing the classic Escape from New York, followed by The Thing, followed by Christine, and that is a really good triple feature.
Yeah, I mean, those are the next three.
Those are the next three. I love talking movies. It's my favorite subject of all time. I fucking love movies. I've always loved movies. Every single time I watch a movie, if it's a good one, it's Christmas Day for me. Like, it's the one thing in my life that, and I gotta stop saying that. I have a great set of people in my life that, so other than a human contact, I would say it's the one thing in my life that consistently for 40 plus years has never let me down and has always made me happy. So I fucking love movies, and you're probably, I won't say you're my favorite on this recorded podcast because I don't offend anyone else that I love talking to too, but I would definitely say, man, you're absolutely,
are you recording? I'm just kidding. Again, you check down and go, oh my god,
no. Fuck, start over again. What did we talk about?
I got
about
somebody at home that's not gonna be happy. Yeah.
And you're not leaving here until it's recorded. I was like, well, how do I twist his arm to come over here? And I'm like, well, shit, maybe I could offer Carpenter. And I mean, it's like, thing, you know, like yeah, pulling off. We love talking about it. So.
No, it's only the second time I've screened anything over here, right?
Yeah.
The first, Suspirio, yeah, Suspirio is the first one, which there's the Argento back again.
Anytime you want to do a podcast about Suspirio, I'm totally down.
After our Carpenter run.
Hey, for real, thanks for coming over and doing this, man. I hope you had a good time, and I'm looking forward to, again, John Carpenter episode 2 will be Escape from New York, The Thing, and Christine. So if you're listening and you want to join us for the second episode, do your homework and watch those movies. So,
cool. It's a blast, dude.
All right, bro. Thanks, man.
Yep.
Thank you again to my guest, Mark Talley, who, as you heard, will be riding shotgun with me till the end on this John Carpenter career retrospective. And a huge thanks to the show's producer, Gigi Leige, without whom this podcast would never exist. If you liked what you heard on today's episode, please subscribe to the channel and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, stay sick.